So thank you all for coming to the Not Confessed. Today it's my honor to talk to you about how software evolution has changed and how David changed it. So David's research area is software engineering. And this is the study of programmers and programming. It's trying to figure out what are the best and most effective ways to design, develop, and maintain software. And of course, what are the ways that people actually do such things? Maintenance is kind of a funny word to apply to software. You don't have to change the oil on your for loops. You don't have to replace the tires on an if statement every 30,000 miles. So maintenance really means writing new software, writing software to do something completely different. It means evolving. And so evolution, software evolution is what David has chosen to focus a lot of his energy on. And it's actually a very canny choice, because in any successful software, 90%+ of all the effort goes into software evolution. So software evolution, then, is trying to figure out how to understand, manage, and reduce the costs of change. And this is something that David has done very well. In fact, he's been a contributor to the tremendous success of software engineering. Lots of people like to complain about software, maybe almost as much as they like to complain about the weather. But software has been incredibly successful, and there is no part of your life, there is no part of business that isn't touched by software. If you want to complain about it, try living a day without the benefits of software. It provides most of the value in our gadgets. The economic impact on our economy is enormous. And every year, we can do more and more, and we expect more and more of software, because the software engineers are enabling programmers to give you more and more. When David was in school, it was plausible to call a 500-line program large. Today, a 500,000-line program is medium-sized, and I'm running a 50-million-line program to show you this presentation. And we're not done yet, because we always want to do more, because software gives us so much more. And the narrative I want to tell you is about how David Notkin has contributed to this wild success. Now, this is actually not an easy thing to do. He's chosen a very difficult field. One reason it's challenging is because there's a lot of mathematics. You need to modeling and analysis of the program objects themselves. But unlike other areas of engineering, where you could imagine having a model of the entire system, there's a non-ideal component. There's a non-linear component that's in the system. That's people. And so both of these aspects are intellectually very deep. The analysis of the program artifact, the analysis of the people, understanding what each needs and how to put them together. And so in this talk, I want to discuss just a few challenges that software engineering has faced, and how software engineering has helped to solve those challenges, or at least prepare us for the next set of challenges, and how David has been a key component of that advance of this field. So this is a very partial list of David's contributions to software engineering. I'd actually love to talk about all of these, but I can't. I'm going to talk about a much smaller set. I'm going to talk about 6 specific projects, each at a very low level, not in much detail at all. I'll talk about a project on refactoring, one on architecture, one on code clones, one on model checking, one on specification mining, and one on structure-oriented computing. And for each topic, I'm going to first try to tell you what it is, what's the problem that we're trying to solve here. Then I'll tell you how it was viewed BD. That's before David. Then I'll talk about the research contribution. And then I'll tell you how it's viewed now, AD, after David. And I'm going to use these 2 icons. To help you remember which is which. So the first thing I want to talk about is refactoring. A refactoring is when you change your program, and you're not changing your program to fix a bug or to add new functionality. You're changing your program, and you're ending up with a program with exactly the same functionality you had before. So why would you do this? Well, because it improves the ilities. It improves testability, maintainability, extensibility, robustness, performance. How many people in this room have ever done refactoring on a program? How many of you are software engineering researchers? This is important way beyond software engineering. This is perhaps one of the most fundamental practices of programmers. It is at the basis of all the agile methods. Here are a few books that are just about refactoring. So the story before David is pretty simple. There wasn't a notion of refactoring. David, Bill Griswold, and others observed a couple of things. One thing they noticed is that if you build a system and then you start to extend it, you end up with a certain system built, a certain design. And that's a different system than you would have built if you'd known all the features ahead of time and you'd had one design that incorporated them all. So there are many different ways to build a system, and they have different benefits. Another observation came from Sir Tony Hoare. He was talking about how to transform programs into other programs, and of course, his interest was in verification. He said that you can convert every program into a normal form, and of course, that's the one you want to verify then. But Bill and David put these ideas together, and what they saw is that all the different designs of a program can be reached via these algebraic transformations. That is, you can transform any design for a program into any other design through well-understood transformations. They're now well-understood anyway. So they built a restructuring tool that preserved meaning. So the idea here is that the programmer decides what to do, and then the system does it for the programmer. And you get a guarantee that the system is transformation is correct. How do you do that? Well, by representing the program meaning with a tool called the program dependence graph, and then doing various transformations over that. So what can we take away from this? I mean, the main thing is just the very notion of refactoring, a meaning-preserving restructuring. This was not a word that people knew. It was not a concept that they'd fixed in their minds. And they were fortunate to bring together a lot of previous work and then expose this idea. And today, every IDE supports refactorings, and every programmer does them. And then there were a bunch of technical contributions as well, like the use of the PDG, these transformation rules that enabled them to do reasoning and be efficient, and some visualization contributions as well. I want to talk about another contribution in the area of software architecture. So software architecture is a way of expressing the high-level design of a system. That is, what are the pieces, and how do those pieces interact with one another? And if you've ever walked into a software engineer's office, you've seen this on the whiteboard. Usually, it's drawn in terms of boxes and arrows, but there are other representations as well. This is a way better way to reason about the high-level properties of your system than trying to deal with a huge mass of code. So a question that people had was, so I have an architecture that's written on my board. I have some code that's in my computer. What's the relationship between those? Did I implement the architecture that I meant to? So here's an example. Suppose you have a pipeline architecture. Then you'd like to make sure that all the communication really is in terms of that pipeline. So in other words, communication and interaction between these two components would be fine. Interaction between these two components would be prohibited. It's illegal. So, but in 2002, people didn't know how to bridge this gap between the architecture and the code. They didn't know how to detect when there were violations of the architecture, when the code shouldn't have been doing what it was doing. And they didn't know how to deal with the complicated features that modern programming languages have. So David, together with Jonathan Aldrich, Craig Chambers, and others, created a tool called ArchJava, and it lets you express this in your language. So you can have interfaces like draw or shape and a bunch of ordinary Java code. But then the key idea is you can state what the components are, and you can say that how they're connected. All that's well and good, but the secret sauce is that there's a set of typing rules. And they enforce the architecture. They give you a compile time guarantee that your code actually does what you intend it to do. In a case study, this is the sort of thing that a developer would draw, and this is the sort of thing you could get from the code with a guarantee that it actually is what the code does. They found it actually helped programmers. So the key contribution here was the first truly effective way of getting the architecture and the code in conformance. And then there were a number of technical contributions as well. They discovered that through case studies that the real architectures people use are different than their conceptual models or the things they might have been intending to do. They showed that you can actually enforce all this automatically to give guarantees. And they found that their tool was able to find a bunch of problems, help programmers in that way. I want to talk about a different project, one in code clones. So a clone is just a duplicate. It's a copy. And usually it's because of cut and paste. So suppose you have some document. You make a copy. Then you make another copy and another copy and another copy. And pretty soon you have a lot of clones. So code clones have a bunch of problems. You now have so much code that it's hard to comprehend what it does. And you have this problem of not consistently updating all of those. If you add a feature to one, you might forget to add it to the others. If you fix a bug in one, you might forget to fix it in the others. And this is a mess after you fixed a bug and the customer comes back and says that it's still there. So in 2004, code clones were viewed as a serious problem. And the solution, of course, is prevent people from making clones. So for example, they can have tools that would caution you or prevent you from doing the cut and paste. Or you could, whenever a clone appeared, you could be told to go ahead and refactor immediately to eliminate that clone. There's that refactoring idea again. And this way, you avoid duplication. You avoid the potential for these sorts of errors. How many people here have ever done cut and paste programming? So one question that David and Emma didn't raise her hand. Nicely done, David. That's well trained. So what David and colleagues asked was, are there sometimes reasons that people do cut and paste programming? Because it seems like a few people do it. And the answer is yes. So David, together with Myeryoung Kim and others, did an empirical study of code clones and their history over time. And what they found is that most of these clones are short-lived and then they diverge. And even the ones that live a long time can't be refactored due to limitations of the underlying programming language or limitations of the standard refactoring approaches. Much deeper analysis would be necessary. So the conclusion here was quite the opposite of the common consensus. It's that if you do proactive refactoring, that can actually be counterproductive. That's not necessarily what you want. They did a number of other things. They had some tools that helped them match versions of code over time. They had tools that let them take a 10,000-line diff and express it as a single clear English sentence instead. So one part of the impact here is that David has been proposing that we should not think of analyzing one program and then maybe applying that multiple times in multiple instances over time. We should actually think about program analyses that inherently look at multiple versions of a program, because you can learn a lot from that. This promoted research in mining software repositories, and his work and that of his colleagues helped to direct the field toward the most relevant, both scientifically and practically interesting problems as well. I want to give another example, which is model checking. Don't tell my colleagues that I told you this, but model checking is just our fancy word for brute force search. So here's an example. Here's a graph, and the question is, can you get to the jail without passing Go? Well, if you want to do model checking, here's what you would do. You would say, here's a way. Does that get there? No, that's not an example. Well, we'd better check this one. Is that an example? No. Well, I'd better check this one going up here, because that might be, well, that's not. Maybe we'll go around this loop a few times. That's the idea of model checking. So in the late 1990s, model checking had actually been applied very successfully to hardware. I mean, the hardware people are really lucky. They have it quite easy compared to the software people. For one thing, hardware is finite state. There are only so many transistors or other components. And so there's only so many states they can be in. And you can imagine exploring every single possible state of your hardware. It had also been applied to low-level cache coherency protocols. But software was considered too hard. It was an open question whether model checking could be effectively applied to realistic software. It's much more complex. And it's also infinite state. You can keep creating new data structures. And so the number of states to explore is infinite. How can you ever finish looking at all of those via your brute force search? So David, together with William Chan, Paul Beam, Richard Anderson, and others, did the largest software model checking effort to date at the time. So they applied it to the TCAS collision avoidance specification. This is installed on every commercial aircraft over 30 passengers in US airspace and used every day. And they found a ton of errors. There was non-determinism. There was some inconsistency in the definitions by cases. There were places where the outputs were inconsistent, like it would say climb to this altitude, and that altitude was lower. There were other cases where you're below 1,000 feet and it said descend. Bad idea. And all of these were fixed in the next revision of the specification. They also applied this to some specifications that were provided to them by Boeing. I'm not permitted to tell you what the result was, but it was effective. So there were some technical challenges here that David and his colleagues addressed. One was nonlinear constraints having to do with numerical values and collections and others. And essentially, they combined constraint solving and symbolic model checking, totally standard technique now. And one clever idea was representing every constraint as a variable in a binary decision diagram, rather than just representing variable-like things as variables in the BDD. Another thing, a challenge they had to overcome, was figuring out how to deal with large, complicated control structures. And so essentially, they did a bunch of optimizations to that brute force search. There are certain things you don't have to keep exploring, and so don't keep exploring them. They took all their constraints and intersected them with a feasible set to eliminate the infeasible ones and reduce the size of the search space. If you reduce the size of the search space, you can do more brute force searching in the same amount of time. They also found ways to, on the fly, determine new infeasible constraints and remove them from their binary decision diagrams. So this, as I said, this was the largest piece of software that had been model checked at that time. But soon thereafter, everyone accepted that model checking was, of course, a reasonable way to verify software, and even significant software. And it's kind of obvious now. And model checking is today one of the most important program analysis techniques. There are whole conferences that are devoted to model checking. And it's used every day at Microsoft and elsewhere. David was one of the players who helped to make this happen. I want to tell you another piece of work about program specifications. So a specification is a mathematical formal description of the behavior of your code. And it's great for reasoning a task like that. So here I have an example. There's a program, and this program adds up all the elements in an array. And then down below, I have a specification for it that consists of a precondition and a postcondition and a loop invariant. And this is a pretty good case for specifications because the spec is only about twice as long as the program. So back in 1997, there were a lot of papers that had been published that started out in the following way. Let us assume that a specification exists. If so, I have a fully automatic way to generate tests, to select tests, to verify programs, to perform refactorings, to do program modeling, to determine if an upgrade is likely to cause a failure. The only problem with this illustrious line of research is that there weren't any programs with specifications. Programmers just don't write them. They don't want to write them. And all the techniques for extracting a specification from a legacy program, an existing program, were hopelessly unscalable. Now, another fact about the world at that time is that researchers in program analysis are divided into two warring camps. One set of them did verification and static analysis, sound approaches, reasoning style approaches, and the other one did testing and dynamic analysis and profiling and debugging. And these two communities didn't talk to one another because each one knew the other one was completely missing the stuff that's really important about programming. So What David did with Michael Ernst, Bill Griswold, and others was to create a technique for automatically generating specifications. So the idea, which was actually a blasphemous idea at the time, was to try to do a dynamic analysis to try to extract specifications. So the idea is run the program, observe the values as the program computes, and then use machine learning to generalize facts from those executions. What you get back out is a set of properties that was true of the program as it ran. So it might say that x is greater than the absolute value of y. Or for every node in a list, the n.previous.next is n. Or a particular graph is acyclic. So this tells you things that were true of the program. So these mind specifications, they're unsound. Just because something was true on these runs doesn't mean it's always true. They're incomplete because they're missing stuff. And they're wildly useful. So it turns out that if you show them to programmers, programmers are able to do much better on tasks. If you feed them into another tool, those tools, again, are able to handle programs that they would not have been able to handle under any other scenario. Furthermore, despite the theoretical problems of unsoundness and incompleteness, in practice, the output is eerily accurate. So in addition to this sort of heretical idea, this work had combined notions of static and dynamic analysis. It had looked across area boundaries as well. For instance, traditional things like clustering and classification and even inductive logic programming were not effective on the data sets that they were using, but they were able to apply new varieties of machine learning, and now that's a totally standard thing to do in software engineering. The last project I want to tell you about is David's dissertation. It's titled Interactive Structure-Oriented Computing. Now, nobody really remembers the title of the dissertation. What they remember is the name of the tool that was built, and that tool was called Gandalf. At the time, it wasn't really obvious why he'd chosen a name like Gandalf. But this has become more apparent over time. So the problem that they were addressing was that you can write a program, and your program can be broken. It can be broken in a number of ways. One way it could be broken is that you have a dangling else. For instance, here I have some code on the right-hand side. And if the door is open and the resident is not visible, this rings the doorbell. That was not the intended behavior. Another possibility is mistyped keywords. Exactly what type of ringing were you trying to do to that doorbell? So once you have a program that's broken, your IDE can no longer perform analyses to tell you important and interesting facts about about your program. So the idea that David pursued with Nico Haberman and others was structure-oriented computing. That was their term for what's more commonly known as syntax-directed editing. And the idea here is, let's make those mistakes impossible. If we don't like to have those mistakes, let's not let them occur. The problems occur because the programmer is typically editing raw text, that is, just sequences of characters, files. And if you instead have the programmer manipulate trees and graphs that represent the program, you can prevent all of these problems. The program is guaranteed to remain well-formed. Let me make an analogy. Suppose you're trying to write some English text. It's easy to get a prepositional phrase wrong. Like, you're writing the Constitution. You want to write of the United States. You might mess that up. So what you could do instead is, in the IDE, instead of just typing that, you could pull down a menu for introduce prepositional phrase, and then you could have a choice, a list of prepositions that you wouldn't mistype, and then you could do the noun phrase, and you'd probably choose that via a set of menus as well. And you know, sometimes it's really helpful to look back at older research and get a little perspective on it and think about it. And when I look back at this research, what I think is, wow, what a bad idea. This is terrible. Here's a dissertation trying to make it look easy to do an if, and you've got to do an if, and then cursor out, and then cursor previous, and then delete subtree and extend list. Now, David is no dummy. He recognized this. He knew this was a problem. In fact, if you read the dissertation all the way to page 3, he says, "The remainder of my thesis does not directly champion the benefits of structure-oriented editing. Instead, I assume that structure-oriented editors are interesting, and therefore I will study them."
Got me a job.
And on the basis of this, this department hired him. This is another example where I think we can actually learn a lot from David. One thing is that if you think about the goal of having the IDE always able to do powerful analyses on your program, that's a goal that every IDE aims for today. Whenever your program is valid, they always maintain a parse structure so that they can always perform these powerful analyses. The technique is a rather different one to achieve it, but the goal is exactly the same. Another thing that I think we can learn from this is to aim high. Try hard things. And then, if you have a failure, that's not the end of the world. Maybe there's another way to attack the problem. Maybe you'll discover it. Maybe someone else will discover it after you. And maybe you just need to move on. Find some new problems, find some new collaborators, and be successful there. Another lesson is, I think, the lesson from this department. You need to judge people by their merits. Don't judge them by one thing that they've done. And I think that's something this department did very well in hiring David. So if we think about the impacts that David Notkin has had, I've mostly focused on the very substantial technical successes that David has had in this challenging, intellectually deep, practically important field of software engineering that touches not just software engineering researchers, but everyone on the globe. I've showed you just a few of his projects. I could have talked about 5 times as many and given you other vignettes about how he saw a problem in a different way. He and his colleagues changed the way that people think about these problems. I want to mention another big effect that David has had, which is on mentoring as well. So it hasn't just been creating software. It hasn't just been creating technology. But for David, it's really always been about the people. And so he's had a long string of students and others that he's helped. If you're one of David's students, could you stand up? If you're one of their students, could you stand up? And if you've ever been helped by David's mentoring, could you stand up? Thank you, David.
Explaining to me and especially my family what I actually did.
Yes, thank you very much.
And Emma has never used a refactoring tool in her life, but we'll overcome that. You should give the name Gandalf to Nico, who really picked it more than I did. But more than all, it's great to see everybody here. And each one of these projects, Mike didn't make a big deal out of it, basically could be associated with one or a couple of students. Bill, Mike, Jonathan, Gail, and so forth down the line. I have listed everybody. And that's pretty amazing. But they get the responsibility and the credit for doing a bunch of great work. I just try not to get in their way too often. So thank you very much for coming, and I hope we get a chance to have something to drink and something to eat and talk to each other for a while. But mostly, thanks a ton, Mike. That took a lot of work to find some positives in what I did. and you search deep and you search wide, and somehow you picked out a couple of gems. Thank you.